Buy with Rob is your best choice when purchasing your new home in the Puget Sound area. Call 360-710-9425 today and get started on the best home buying experience you will ever have. Go to buywithrob.com today.
Hey, this is YD from the Ale Evangelist Show, and you're listening to the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Hey, did I tell you guys I got a goat?
The year was 1489. The Black Plague ravaged the continent. It was the hour of the infamous auto da fe, where for public amusement, heretics and non-believers were tortured and burned in a carnival-like atmosphere. And it was guided by the most fearful specter to ever sit in judgment over good and evil, the Grand Inquisitor. Torquemada.
All pay heed. Now enters His Holiness, Torquemada, the Grand Inquisitor of the Spanish Inquisition. Torquemada, let's face it, you can't talk him out of anything.
Little column A, little column B.
Yeah, baby.
Well, good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, wherever you are. Whatever you do, a lot of things happening in the world today. Most of them are far beyond our control, you might say. So perhaps it's time we took a pause and thought about life, thought about the laws of gravity, history, the past, the present, the future, politics, and or the news. Don't touch that dial. Just try to hear me out for a while. Well, Smithsonian Magazine came out with an article yesterday lamenting the fact that there are 30% less history majors than there used to be. Why? I got a few thoughts on the matter. Stuff happened in the Senate yesterday. People seem surprised, but really? Murphy Brown has been canceled. I barely even knew it was back. And Tom Petty once said that vinyl recordings are far better than digital ones. Is he right? Here's how you get a hold of me. The text machine is area code 209-565-DAVE. 209-565-3283. The email is dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. Of course, we're on the web. Just look for The Dave Bowman Show on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, or your preferred non-denominational web search engine, which will take you to thedavebowmanshow.com or podcast99.org, where you can get the show live and on demand. Ego bierbi capula ut ale vivere. I drink coffee that others might live. Well, happy Friday, everybody. Made it through the week. That first week after Thanksgiving, Ben was like... I feel like I haven't been to school on Friday in an age. It's been a week, buddy, but you get the idea. Smithsonian Magazine had that article yesterday. What happened to history? Apparently, there are 30% less history majors than there used to be. Now, what the article did not address was other disciplines. I mean, how many English majors are there compared to the same time frame? Comparatively speaking, have English majors gone up or down? I suspect, and this is my own opinion, but I suspect that they have gone down, just like they have for math majors and science majors and the likes of that. In a society where the general idea is you have to go to college or somehow or another you're a life's failure, more and more people are going to be pushed towards disciplines that are, I don't want to be sound denigrating or condescending, but they're underwater basket weaving degrees. They're communications degrees, degrees that don't really, resolve themselves into anything that I can picture being worthwhile. Now, again, I say that as someone who went to college for an entire day and decided it wasn't for me. I am intrigued by the argument over history degrees and history majors for a lot of reasons. One, if you've been around this show for more than 5 minutes, you know that I am a historian. That's my primary vocation, I guess, amongst everything else. If you look at the shelves behind me, this over here, this entire shelf from top to bottom and this shelf from top to bottom are basically nothing but history books of various types. Over here, this is, wait, I got to get my finger. This shelf here is history of sports, particularly baseball, this shelf down here is my recreational reading, my Clive Cussler shelf. And these two shelves up here are classical books. Some of them are history. Some of them are not. Shakespeare, that sort of thing. I'm a historian. I'm somebody who loves history. But I didn't come by that naturally. I didn't just get up one morning and go, you know what, today I'm a historian. It didn't happen that way. That's not how these things start. Near as I can tell, thinking about it, it would have been roughly 1973, I think. Somewhere in there, 73, 72, 73, 74, somewhere in there. Family trip. We used to go to Oklahoma City on a fairly regular basis. My grandparents lived there. We lived in Colorado. It was not unusual for us to basically every weekend go back to Oklahoma City, particularly in the early years. But it was a fairly often made trip. I don't think we ever went more than 6 months without making that trip. But on this particular trip, we stopped, I believe it was Dodge City, but it might have been somewhere else. And I learned about the Dalton Gang. And that was my introduction to American Western history, something that to this day still fascinates me. I wouldn't call it my passion, but the history of the American West is something that intrigues me. Some years later, it would have been 1976, I was sitting, I was working on some project or something, and I couldn't figure out how to pronounce the Maginot Line. And so I had gone to my father and said, how do you pronounce this? And in one of those remarkable moments that still sticks in my mind, we sat around the dining room table for probably 2 hours talking about the history of World War II. Now, my father was born in 1940, so he didn't participate, but my grandfather did. And my father was well familiar with those events and those things of that era. And so we talked through it from his perspective. And it was shortly after that, in my sophomore year in high school, that I met my history teacher, Ray Miller, of blessed memory. Mr. Miller has long passed on. Mr. Miller was a fascinating individual. He was very short. He was basically blind. He's the kind of guy that, you know, when you handed him your paper, he would take his glasses off and look at it real close. The way I do now, I do that now. I got to get bifocals, and my vanity keeps me from doing it. But at any rate, Mr. Miller was the guy that taught me, well, there's two specific things that I remember from him. Number one was the three causes of World War I were militarism, imperialism, and nationalism. And the second thing I remember from him passionately teaching me is that history is not dates and places. It's not what happened on October 3rd, 1498. I mean, that's a starting point, but that's not history. That's a record. History is about people. History is about motivations and understandings and realizations and thought processes. It's about getting to know why something happened as much as it is about getting to know what happened on a given day. And I have carried that with me for the rest of my life. In fact, I can't tell you how many times I've tried to explain that as I talk about history. It's not about necessarily what happened and when. I mean, that's a starting point. You got to start somewhere, and I get that, but you have to approach it as if somehow or another you can connect with it. I'm a very tactile person. I like to put my hands on history, and that has gotten me in trouble on more than one occasion when I've gone to some historical site of some nature and found myself wanting to connect with it in such a way that I felt the need to actually put my hands on it. And if you know anything about, you know, museums and history sites, they get a little touchy about that sometimes. There are some places you can go where it's not an issue, but most places you can't do that. So, but for me, it becomes important to connect with it. The discovery of my family some years ago, it was probably 2005-ish, before we really got into any kind of genealogy about my family, learning about anything in my family. And the discovery, I still remember the exhilaration that I felt the day that I discovered my great-grandfather, was a cavalry trooper during the Civil War. it was astonishing. I mean, the emotion that I felt in, when that connection two generations ago, my family was fighting for freedom. It's an amazing feeling. And then later on, you know, discovering that I have American Revolutionary War family folks and Western Plains history and that sort of thing. It's intriguing, but that's my family. When you move beyond that and you get into the rest of the world, what connects us to them? One of my favorite professors, Professor Ellett, talks about the fact that conservatism in general, not as a political ideology, but as a philosophy, tends to believe that people are, that there's a sameness in people throughout history. And that if we were to go back in time and meet people, I don't know, 400, 500, 600 years ago, we would recognize in them the same thought patterns and the same motivations and the same ideologies that we have today. And that's why we tend to think about things in a certain way. It's a fascinating philosophy, and I find myself not disagreeing with it because I believe very firmly. This is Dave's second law. People don't change. They do the same things for the same reasons throughout history. The only thing that changes is technology. And so technology lets people convince themselves that, hey, this time it'll be different. And it rarely is. That's the catch. It rarely is different, even though we like to pretend it is. But anytime you talk about history, you have to go to George Santayana and his infamous quote, which is often misquoted. I found myself last night misquoting it as I was doing the show prep. Like, people who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And so I wrote this whole soliloquy about people who don't learn from history, blah, 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 blah. And then I thought, well, I better go look up the actual quote to actually get the actual verbiage. And of course, the word learn isn't in there, is it? So that's the problem. The actual quote: those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Now, you can put a lot of emphasis on that word remember, and you can put a lot of definitions on that word remember, but if we were to take it at its basic epistemological function, we need to remember what happened. Is there an element of understanding in that? Sure. Is there an element of learning from that? Sure. But primarily, it's, you put your hand on a hot stove, it burns. If you don't remember that, you're going to burn your hand again, right? I mean, that's the basic idea here. Santayana was, he was grasping at an idea here. He was sharing with an idea here that I think is important. I think it's so important that it's lost its thrust, I suppose, because it's been so often repeated and so oftenly misapplied and so oftenly, if oftenly is a word, misinterpreted, that it's almost become a cliche. It really has. Those who can't remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And we throw it out there every time there's something we don't like that's been tried before, forgetting the fact that we're human beings. We're going to keep trying the same things for the same reasons. And so rather than appealing to the reasoning of why we're doing something, we just jump right back to Santayana. Hey, you don't remember what happened last time? You're going to fail again. It's going to fail, or this is going to happen, or that's going to happen again. And I think we lose what he's actually trying to tell us here because we're focused on the quote rather than the actual point at issue. It's a way that history is misused in our current present. We don't think about things the way we should be thinking about them because we're looking to the past. Santayana is an interesting guy. He also said this: history is a pack of lies about events that never happened, told by people who weren't there. I'm guessing that he had a bad experience with his own past being reported in a way that he did not necessarily like. We all have that. We all have people that talk about us in the past. They weren't there. They assume things. I can't tell you how many times I've been assumed about things. People say, well, you're a radio talk show host, a conservative radio talk show host. Well, then you must believe that, blah, blah, blah. They don't know me. They weren't there. They don't understand those things. That can be very frustrating. And then he went on to complete the trifecta. History is always wrong, and so it always needs to be rewritten. This is fascinating to me because this gets more into the political machinations of things. History today, and this, it's kind of 1984-ish, history is, tends to be interpreted in a way that makes it so that it fits whatever political agenda is the, you know, the flavor of the day. If we want to be conservatives, then we find conservatives in history. If we want to be liberals, then we find liberals in history, and we celebrate those things. And in all of that, we forget the biggest problem with all of history. And for me, it's kind of a, it's one of those things that I value quite extensively. I took some courses a few years ago on some history issues, and they weren't directly history classes, I guess. This particular one happened to be a history of conservatism, believe it or not. And the professor was fascinating to me, Professor Allitt. And he gave me something that I treasure right up there with what Mr. Miller gave me, and that is, history is strange. History is alien. It will not give you what you want it to give you. If you watch something, if you read something, if you think about something in history, and it completely 100% validates your political views, it's probably not history. It's probably propaganda. Or you haven't read everything that there is to read about it, or heard everything that there is to hear about it. You haven't completed your studies. If everything you see in history completely and utterly backs up your philosophies, you didn't read it all. You didn't read it right. You missed something somewhere, because history will not do that for you. Thomas Jefferson's a great example. Thomas Jefferson is held up by libertarians as the mantelpiece of libertarianism. He's held up as the person who best represents what libertarianism is all about. And yet Thomas Jefferson probably wouldn't recognize libertarianism as practiced today. Thomas Jefferson, like most politicians, was a pragmatist. He did what he thought was best at the moment, not always guided by his philosophy. Remember, he's the man that wrote the words, "All men are created equal," but he was also the man who owned slaves. He's a man who wanted to end slavery. He accused King George of causing slavery. He hated slavery, yet he owned slaves. He was a man that believed that the Constitution should be interpreted as, if it doesn't say you can do it, you cannot. And then he went and bought Louisiana. There are some fascinating things in history, and there are some fascinating ways to look at it, and there are questions about what happened to it and what does it all mean. Some years ago, 1997, I had the privilege of going to Israel. It was, I refer to it as the best 10 days of my life. I mean, I really do. If I had time to talk about that trip, and I can't believe that it was, you know, more than almost 30 years ago, right? 1970. That was 22 years ago. It was a marvelous trip. I was actually there on my birthday. My birthday happened to be on Shabbat, and it was an incredible experience. I went with as a part of a tour group. And during the day, we would take the tour. And then at night, when the tour was over, a good friend of mine and I would get in a cab and we would go see Israel at night on our own. And it was some of the memories of that, of being at the Western Wall at midnight, was an incredible experience. But one of the best parts of this trip for me was to go to Jericho. Now, Jericho, for those of you who may not know this, is perhaps one of the oldest inhabited cities in the history of mankind. It is considered to be one of the oldest, if not the oldest, functioning city in history. Depending on who you talk to, it's anywhere from 3,000 to 8,000 to 10,000 years old. Now, I know some of you are going, "Dude, the world's only 6,000 years old." Let's deal with it. Jericho, of course, famous in the Bible for having been conquered by the Israelites as Joshua marched around the city seven times and they blew the trumpets and blah, blah, blah. And Joshua fit the battle of Jericho. The walls came tumbling down. It's also famous for its archaeology. Jericho is one of the most visited archaeological sites in all of the world, and as it should be because of its age and what it represents. When we got to Jericho on that tour, the buses rolled up to the parking lot, and this is not obviously what Jericho looks like today. There's a little restaurant off to the side, and the tour leaders announced, okay, we're going to have lunch, and then we'll take a quick tour of Jericho. And I looked at my then wife and said, quick tour of Jericho? And she rolled her eyes, and the tour leader guy said, Dave, what do you mean? I said, I want to go see Jericho. He said, well, we're going to have lunch first. I said, I've come 10,000 miles. I can skip a meal to go see Jericho. And he said, okay, just don't get into any trouble. Don't do anything rash or wrong. And so off I went. This is a picture I took in Jericho, and you are looking at the walls of ancient Jericho. I know you kind of look at it and you go, well, how would you know? I mean, you have to understand that all of this has been buried over. They build on top of this stuff when a city wants to rebuild. I mean, we do it today. San Francisco, Seattle, Oklahoma City, they all have underground portions of the city where they've built on top of this, and they've built on top. And eventually, 10,000 years from now, somebody will excavate all the way down to the bottom of that and go, hey, look, people lived here then. When you look at these walls and you realize what they represent, you can't help but stand there, and I did, in a sense of awe. It was an amazing experience. While everybody else ate, I went to Jericho. And of course, because I wasn't with the tour, I ended up going places that the tour did not normally go. This is one of them. Photo I took in 1997. This is the base looking in towards one of the first trenches that was dug to excavate Jericho. The Kenyon Trench is famous for what it has discovered, and you can't really see it. You actually have to go back past where the shadows there are to get out into the main area to see what's discovered. But it's off the tourist path. You can see up there in the upper right, you can see the fence, and then in the center of the back of the picture, you can actually see the place where the tourists stand and look down. And you can see from the picture that I'm on the other end of that. Well, how did I get there? That's between me and the security guard that asked me not to do that again. At any rate, I stood in that trench for a good bit of time, and I held in my hands bricks that could be as much somewhere, again, depending on who you believe, somewhere between 4 and 10,000 years old. And as you look at those things, and as you touch them, as you feel them, and I don't know about you, but as I said, I have a connection for me that's tactile. And when I touch things that are history, I can almost feel and sense the beginnings of them. And as I stood in the bottom of that trench right there, looking around, looking at things and feeling them with my hands, you simply come to the realization that 10,000 years ago, people built these walls. What would their motivation be? Why would they feel the need to build walls? What were they doing that necessitated this? What were they thinking? How did they plan this? Did they really believe that walls could protect them? Did they think about the fact that someday some Jewish guy would come around with a bunch of trumpets and blow them and knock them down? All of these things are rolling through my mind, but I'm realizing that people, human beings, not unlike you or me, built these walls. That's history, folks. That's when you can see it like that, and you can feel it, and you can touch it, and you can understand the ideas that went into it, then you can go and say to yourself, okay, what lessons can be drawn from this? The lessons that you draw from any history are going to be influenced by your own biases. If you're conservative, you're going to look at the conservative values. If you're a progressive, you're going to look at the progressive values. If you're in the middle, you're going to look in the middle values. If you're Protestant, you're going to look at Protestant values. If you're Catholic, you're going to look at Catholic values. I'm not kidding. If you go to the Holy Land, you'll understand what I'm talking about. If you go to the Holy Land and you go to Bethlehem, right? So you go to the Church of the Nativity, the ancient Catholic Church of Nativity, and they take you down into the cave and you see there the star where the Christ child was born. And you look over to the side and you'll see a huge, I mean, it's huge. It's like when I ride out of a castle, one of those huge oak doors, wooden doors with a padlock on it. And you think to yourself, oh, they don't want people getting out in the rest of the cave and going all Tom Sawyer on them. So they've prevented you from getting lost in the cave, right? And then you go back out and then you go to the other church, which is the not Catholic church. I guess Protestant would be the best way to put it. Church of the Nativity. And you go in their church and then you go down in their cave and you see the nativity scene and you see the star. And this is where the Christ child was born. And then you look over there and you see a heavy oak wooden door with a padlock on it. And you realize it's the same door. It's the other side. You got two different peoples claiming the same thing as history, and they put up a wall between themselves so that you don't get influenced. And they do it all over the place. I mean, you go to Golgotha, right? The place where Jesus is executed. You go to the Catholic one, and it's this huge church built around this little mound where the execution of Jesus was supposed to have taken place. And then you go to the Protestant one, and it's you know, not the same place, but same idea. And then there's a third one that's, I would classify it evangelical. All these different ideas of history, all these different ideas of what this must be, and all these different ideas of what history is. And it's tailored to fit their ideologies and their theologies. And that's what we have to be careful of. And I think if you really go into what Satayana is saying about history remembered, he really is digging into that essence of, do we remember it as reality, or do we remember it the way we choose to remember it? The reason it has to be constantly rewritten is because our philosophies change, our political ideologies change, our political needs change. And so naturally, in a very 1984-esque way, we have to change the history to fit the ideology. And because we do that, then we get into this history becomes lies thing. And it becomes this point where history is so twisted and so stretched and so manipulated by political ideology or even theological ideology that we recognize the fact that it's not true. I mean, we all know George Washington didn't cut down a cherry tree. We know this. We all know that the framers were, you know, slaveholders, but somehow or another that gets twisted into they were misogynists and they were evil people because that fits an ideology on the other side, taking a bit of history and remembering it a completely different way. I've talked about this before. One of the most seminal moments of my career has been standing there with a 17-year-old high school senior explaining to me that she didn't need to read about Washington, didn't need to read about Hamilton or Adams or Jefferson or any of those guys because she had read Marx and Lenin and they told her that those people were all lying to her. Well, if that's how we read history, the parts I don't like are lies, we go right back to what Professor Allitt said. History is strange. It won't give you what you want. And if you read history in such a way that it 100% supports your political ideology, what you're actually reading is propaganda, myth, because it will not give you what you want. It will not give you what you think it says, because it can't. In the same way that you yourself are not what other people have decided you are, history is the same thing because it's people. It's people. And who are you and who am I to put them in the definitive box that I have written for them? You know, we look at all of history. We look at characters in history. And one of my favorite images of history is an 8-year-old Tutankhaten running around the palace, laughing and having fun. By everything we know of history, by everything we've seen of his father, Akhenaten, or Amenhotep IV, depending on what you prefer, Amenhotep IV was a devout family man, loved his kids, of which Tutankhamun was one of the youngest, but he would be the only one that would survive. And I wonder how many of us, you know, as we've gone to these exhibits and we've seen the earthly remains of Tutankhamun, we know him as Tutankhamun, King Tut. And we've defined him as that. We've defined him as the boy king. We've defined him as the man behind the golden mask. But what do we really know about him? That image of him running around that palace to me is just, it's a connection point for me. Because I have an 8-year-old that runs around here. When he's 10, will I be gone? What can I do to teach him in history and to show him how to review those things and how to learn those things and how to understand them and how to apply them is what really matters. One of the greatest historical failings in all of history is that Tutankhamun did not learn from his father. His father has gone down in history as establishing the first monotheistic religion in all of history. Did you know that? Akhenaten. And yet Tutankhamun changed his name, Tutankhamun, and reestablished the religion of his grandfathers, which basically doomed his dynasty to failure. Those are the little lessons and little currents in history that I find so fascinating. The places that I like to go, the things that I like to stop at, the markers that I see on the side of the road, you know, a 3-billion-year-old rock. These are things that we can touch, we can learn from. Why are less people studying history today? I think there's two reasons why. Number one, college is ridiculously expensive. I would love to have my degree in history. I'm not lying to you. I think that I could, you know, I think I have the knowledge base level sufficient to prove that I should have one, but I'm not about to hand over some college $6,000 to $12,000 to hand me a piece of paper saying ipso facto definto bumba lapsi Latin ipsium, you know, history. I don't need a piece of paper to tell me that. I don't need to pay somebody to be able to say Dave knows that. You either trust me or you don't. I mean, I would tell you point blank, don't just take what I say at face value. Go research it. Go study. It should be a starting point, not an ending point. Just like Mr. Miller used to tell me. I can tell you what I think, but you need to go find what you think. History is a place to start with that. That's the first reason. College is too expensive. Number two, history has become so politicized now that people only look at what they want to hear. Professor Alit says they're only reading the mythology. They're only reading the myth that supports their political ideology. And in doing so, I think it's a fear. I think they're afraid of it. I think they're afraid of finding out that what they believe might not be true or might not have happened the way they think it happened. And once you head down that road, people get testy, people get argumentative, people get mad when that happens, and so I think that has a lot to do with it. What do you think? Area code 209-565 Dave is the text machine. You can let me know. Email Dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And yeah, I went long, but history is a passion of mine for a lot of reasons. One of which is that I believe it's valuable. I believe it's important. And if we don't study it, if we don't remember it, we are doomed to repeat it. Condemned to repeat it. But we also have a responsibility as historians to make sure that these rewrites of history that are being done for political and theological reasons are challenged. It's our job as historians to make sure that history does remain strange, that it doesn't give everybody exactly what they want. And if we don't do it, who will? Got to take a break. Stay with us. It's the Dave Bowman Show on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
What's up, Whitey?
Hey, Scotsman.
We're from the Ale Evangelist Show, and you are listening
to the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Radio Network.
listening to The Dave Bowman Show on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Hey, welcome back. This is Dave. It's a Friday episode. You want to join me? Area code 209-565-DAVE is the text machine. It's 565-3283. It's also the voicemail machine. Email remains Dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And, of course, we're on the web. Just look for The Dave Bowman Show on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and thedavebowmanshow.com. Or podcast99.com or .org, sorry, where you can get the show live and on demand. History is one of those things that just, it's my passion, folks. It really is. I mean, I wish I had the time to just sit here and read books all day long. These books over here that I'm pointing to, I'm trying to figure out which way to move on the camera. It's backwards. Those are Durant's History of Civilization. And at one point in my career, those particular books right there that you see, those books I have had since the 1980s, and I have dragged them cross country multiple times. I was getting one of my annual reviews, I guess, from my supervisor back when I was a pastor. And one of the things that they said was, you don't seem to have a lot of friends. You don't seem to have much of a social life. You don't go out and I didn't have any kids or anything at that time. And, my marriage at the time was rather rocky. And so they were concerned about my emotional well-being. He says, what do you do for fun? I said, I read. He says, what do you read? And I reached back and on my bookshelf over my desk, and I pulled out one of the copies. And I read this. And he looked at me and said, you read Durant for fun? Yeah, I still do. It's not unusual if you were to pull those books off the shelf back there. It's not unusual to go through them and find places where I've, you know, just, it seems random where I've highlighted or underlined or pinched or written notes in the sides of them. And someday my son will have those. And I hope that he will appreciate them as much as they have meant to me. It took me a while to collect all those. But I have, like I said, dragged them to and fro across the country every time I go. There is breaking news, however, that we must get to. Anchorage, Alaska has been hit by a 6.6 magnitude earthquake, rocking buildings, prompting people to run out of offices and seek shelters. This was about 45 minutes ago. So, yeah, roughly 45 minutes ago. Officials have issued tsunami warnings for coastal areas of southern Alaska. Cook Inlet, let's see, police on Alaska's Kodiak Island told community residents to head to higher ground. AP is reporting cracks in buildings. At this time, it is unclear whether there were any injuries. Initially, the USGS said it was a 6.7 magnitude. They have since reduced that to 6.6, which I know sounds silly. I mean, you know, 6.6, what's the difference? Remember that the scale is not linear, it's exponential. So a 6.6 to a 6.7 could be significant. There have been photographs to social media sites showing collapsed ceiling tiles at the high school. There's one picture here that shows a road that looks like it's hard to tell because there's a lot of snow. But it looks like a road has collapsed. And there's a picture here of stores, ceilings falling down, pipes broken. 6.7 is a pretty significant earthquake, folks. So the folks up in Alaska, and obviously we'll hear more over the next few hours, I'm sure. It's always been intriguing to me. Again, history, you go to history and you talk about earthquakes, it's a part of human history. I mean, earthquakes are how many times in human history have earthquakes changed human history? And a 6.6 in the United States is kind of a, I mean, California, 6.6, we might notice it. I mean, it might make the news. But in some parts of the world, a 6.6 earthquake could be devastating because their technology and their society isn't up to the building code standards that we have here in the United States. That's something I've always found fascinating, is that, you know, an earthquake that you might not notice here in the States, and particularly in places like California or Alaska, is a huge, can become a huge tragedy in other parts. And that tsunami warning, of course, is, that's what gets people's attention now. I mean, our phones have been going off here for a while about a potential tsunami warning. This is the part I like, is it doesn't even apply to us. But somehow or another here in Washington State, we're getting tsunami warnings because it's a big deal. We live near the coast. We live near the place, and on we will go. So there's that issue in what's going on today. So we want to keep that in mind. In the Senate yesterday of the United States, there were debates and arguments about a myriad of things. But I guess the story that just has me, I don't know, shaking my head. It was all over social media yesterday, and it's one of those stories where people are looking at this story and it fits their political agenda, so they jump on it. And that is, of course, the defeat of the bill to get the United States out of the war in Yemen. Did you know we were in a war in Yemen? Did you know that we're part of that? How many of you actually knew that? So the Senate yesterday, they had a resolution to end the United States' involvement in this war in Yemen, which this goes back to the Khashoggi killing. This goes back to the idea that Saudi Arabia is our friend, but they're kind of a frenemy. You know, the hijackers of 9/11 were Saudis. Saudi Arabia is the home of Wahhabism, which is the most violent form of the PLRI. And somehow or another, with friends like that, who needs enemies, I guess, is the bottom line that some people have felt. So this war in Yemen is actually Saudi Arabia doing this. Saudi Arabia has issues with Yemen that go beyond the scope of this show and have continued this. And of course, we're providing them with the weapons and the bombs and the money that they need to continue this war against Yemen, which is ostensibly against the terrorists. The terrorists are the bad guys, supposedly, and so we don't like the terrorists either, so they're helping us. They are a strong ally, as we say, in the fight against terrorism, and thus hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Yemenis continue to be killed and or suffer under the warhammer of Saudi Arabia. Right? I mean, that's the general idea here. So the theory is that the Senate, I guess, was going to have a vote yesterday to end the United States' involvement in the Saudi-led civil war, which receives funding from the United States. And so the thing was defeated. Five, however, of the 37 Republican senators who voted against it were lobbied by the Saudis. And this has become big news. Roy Blunt, John Boozman, Richard Burr, Mike Crapo, and is it Crapo or Crapo? I'm going to go with Crapo. Tim Scott of South Carolina, who's also in the news for other things today, but we'll get to him in a minute if we can. But these five senators, United States senators, received financial contributions for elections from firms working for Saudi Arabia in the last couple of years. And this supposedly, let's see, Blunt got $19,200. Buzo, Burr, Crapo, and Scott received between $1,000 and $2,500 from these Saudi-linked firms. Saudi Arabia has spent more than $24 million to influence U.S. foreign policy and public opinion during the 2018 election cycle. That is according to Department of Justice data. Around $18 million of that was paid to foreign agents acting on behalf of Saudi interests. Another $6 million in spending has already been reported this year, making it one of the top 10 countries spending on influence and lobbying in the U.S. Despite the efforts of the lobbyists, however, U.S. sent a strong signal Wednesday that they want to punish Saudi Arabia, not for its war in Yemen, but for the Khashoggi murder. In a quote-unquote bipartisan 63-37 vote, the Senate opted to move forward with legislation calling for an end to all U.S. military support to the Saudi-led coalition in the Yemen war. So the idea here is that the Senate has decided that this is a bad idea and we probably shouldn't be doing this, but it took the death of Khashoggi to bring them to this conclusion, because prior to that, nobody cared. Now, all of a sudden, everybody's uptight about it. Now, all of a sudden, everybody's intrigued. Now, all of a sudden, because somebody that we liked was murdered by somebody that we thought we liked, now it's an issue. And so now we have to go and end the war, at least drive it down. I think the idea of being involved in the war in Yemen is a bad idea. But here's the problem with this, and this is the argument that I've had with the libertarian wing of things that have been celebrating this because they believe that the death of Khashoggi and the subsequent rebukes and the subsequent sanctions against Saudi Arabia because of this death are going to end this war. That's what they believe. They believe that, oh, good, now this war in Yemen can be stopped. No, it's not. Weapons are fungible, folks. Weapons, you can get weapons anywhere. If you don't get them from the United States, do you really honestly think that there aren't other countries out there that would be happy to sell the Saudis weapons? To sell them bombs, to sell them missiles, to sell them things that they need to show them that, hey, look, we can be a better friend than the United States can. They're not buying your oil anyway. You don't need them. We'll buy your oil. And here's some, you know, we'll pay for it with weapons. It might actually be worse for the Yemenis if that were to happen, but nobody wants to think in those terms. Nobody wants to think about those solutions, do they? We go to history and we draw the conclusions that we want to draw and say, well, you know, it's simple. If we stop giving them money, then they can't fight anymore. Except that this isn't the night, you know, this isn't 1622 anymore. Now there are other countries that want those things, and we've failed to make that connection. I don't think the United States should be involved. If you were asking me my personal opinion, I would have voted for the resolution because I don't think we should be involved. I think this is a waste of time. I think that this is a personal vendetta that Saudi Arabia has against Yemen for reasons that, again, go far beyond the scope of this show, but generally deal with the same old crap that you're always dealing with whenever you're dealing with the Islamic world. It's like Ireland in the 1970s. You believe in the same God we do, but you don't believe the way that we think you should, so we're going to drop bombs on you. It's the same old crap that we've been getting for, you know, 1,600 years. They don't like the way that somebody does something or says something, and the fact that there's an international border between them, which should cause them to just go, hey, you know, it's not our problem, doesn't seem to work. Should we be involved with it? No. But are there pragmatic concerns about if we're not, what happens? I mean, I don't have to deal with those things. I'm not the president of the United States. I don't have to deal with the ideas that if we push away an ally in the war on terror, the never-ending global war on terror, what might happen? Maybe they see things that I don't see. Maybe I disagree with things. Maybe it's the same old, you know, well, if you knew what we knew, well, I don't. It's easy for me to sit here and go, this is a dumb thing to do. But really, in the broad spectrum of things, who the hell could possibly be surprised that Saudi Arabia is lobbying senators? And by the way, as unseemly as it might be, and it is unseemly, it's not illegal. Why is it not illegal? Because the Congress people who are being lobbied have passed laws saying that it's legal. That's, you know, they've made it possible for themselves to take this money from lobbyists and then presumably do what they were asked to do. Or maybe not. There's no law that says they can't take the money and then vote against it anyway. And many times they do, which makes you wonder why they would spend the money on that. They're going to spend the money on politicians that they think will do things the way they want it done. It's not illegal. Should it be? Well, maybe. But if it is illegal, how is it going to become illegal? The only way it's going to become illegal is if we start putting people in Congress that are responsible to us. And we're not going to do that. Why do I say that? Because history tells us that it won't. We will continue to do the same things with the same results throughout history for the same reasons. And ultimately, unless we're willing to take charge of it. It's not going to change anything. That's the problem with it. Bismarck called it the Realpolitik. It's a deal with the reality of the situation as it is, not the way you want it to be. Sometimes that offends our sensibilities. Sometimes that makes us angry. Sometimes that makes us outraged, and we feel like we have to say things and do things and point fingers and be mad. If the sun goes down, it doesn't change anything. That's history. I gotta get running. Got much to do today. It's been a good week. Hope you had a good week. Heading into the holidays now. By Sunday night is Hanukkah. I knew it was coming up soon. I didn't realize it was that soon. All the menorahs over there on the deck in the box getting ready to be deployed. Getting ready to start Hanukkah Sunday night. Another year has gone by. I still don't have my giant inflatable. I want a giant inflatable menorah for my house. So I found the one I want. See what happens. I got to get running. Take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life you love them very much. You'd miss them if they weren't there. So don't pass up those opportunities. You don't want to have that regret. Plausibly Live, I'm Dave Bowman, and this is my show, The Dave Bowman Show, right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. We're here every Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time. The Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. You can get us live on Facebook. And on demand on thedavebowmanshow.com as well as podcast99.org. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody, and we will see you on Monday for a brand new episode of The Dave Bowman Show.
Show is a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. For more information or to complain about how the show offended you, the text or voicemail number is 209-565-DAVE. For more information about the show, log on to thedavebowmanshow.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.